Well, one, I welcome you again, and whether you're joining us live or outside in the beautiful weather of Colton, and well, I don't know how beautiful it is, but anyway, glad you're here joining us as well. You know, one April evening in 2006 in the state of Indiana, after working at an event 15 miles away from campus, six Taylor University students and administrators were driving on a local highway when a tractor trailer crossed the median and slammed right into their van. The crash sadly killed five of the passengers immediately upon impact and left one seriously injured and in a coma. It was a stunning and tragic news for Whitney Surak's family, and they were devastated upon hearing that their daughter was among those killed in the wreck. The bodies were not easily discerned, and so the funeral was a simple closed casket ceremony. Meanwhile, the family of Laura Van Ryn, another student in the van, were thrilled that their daughter survived the crash, and they rushed to the hospital to be with her. She was in a coma, but they stood by her for weeks, praying she would wake up and talk to them once again. And then the miracle happened. Laura woke up and made some small steps to recovery. One day, Laura fed herself some applesauce. Another day, she played a game of Connect Four. She was becoming more alert and aware of things. But as time went on, the Van Ryn family became concerned. Some things seemed to come back to Laura, but other things, the comments the families made, they didn't make any sense to her. And then one day, to test her motor skills, doctors told Laura to write her name on a piece of paper. And to everyone's shock, the young lady in the hospital bed wrote the name Whitney Surak. See, Laura Van Ryn and Whitney Surak looked remarkably alike. They had similar builds, similar facial features, straight blonde hair, and the injuries their bodies sustained in the accident made it very difficult to tell the two girls apart. In the hours after the highway collision, the coroner had confused the girl who had died with the one who had lived. This scene is almost too unreal to imagine. Whitney's family had even visited with the Van Ryn family at the hospital, not knowing that they were looking at their very own daughter covered in tubes and bandages. They were right there in her presence, staring her in the eyes, but they didn't know it was their own sweet daughter, Whitney. When they finally learned the truth, they were shocked that they'd been with their own daughter and not even known it. You know, as I hear this story over again, still, so many emotions go through my heart when I think about it. Deep sadness for the Van Ryn family, and deep joy for the Surak family. If only Whitney's family had recognized their daughter there in the hospital, their sadness would have easily turned into gladness. If only they had known it was her all along. Well, you know, in Scripture, we notice that the disciples also faced a case of mistaken identity in the 3 years that they spent with Jesus. See, at that time, the Israelites had faced heavy taxes and military oppression by the Roman government. And as Jesus performed his miracles, messianic expectations in the crowd were at an all-time high, and the people began to wonder if maybe this was indeed the king that they were waiting for. But Jesus did not come for an earthly revolution. He came for a heavenly one. He didn't come to save life. He actually came to die. They could not grasp the identity of Jesus as the sovereign ruler of the entire universe. And throughout the Gospel of Mark, they don't seem to understand that Jesus is the king of the world. He's the one that holds the entire cosmos in his hands. Their failure to accurately identify Jesus led them to fear, to anxiety, to worry. And our failure to recognize Jesus as who he is leads us to fear and anxiety and worry. The truth is that none of us are immune from suffering. If we're not currently experiencing the effects of a broken world, we will. Author Tim Keller said, "No matter what precautions we take, no matter how well we've put together a good life, no matter how hard we've worked to be healthy, wealthy, comfortable, and successful, something will inevitably ruin it." And maybe as you're listening to me today, maybe you're going through a great trial right now. You're depressed and can't seem a way out of your despair. You're disabled and your pain and your handicap are too much to accept. You've recently had a miscarriage and you're heartbroken, or you were physically or sexually abused as a child and you live every day in the haunting memory of what had happened. You're facing perhaps weeks of chemotherapy and you don't know if you can find the strength to make it just one more day. You lost a loved one and you miss him or her very dearly. Folks, there is no guarantee that anything you do will bring happiness or relief. There's no mathematical equation, no magic recipe to make you feel better, no special button to push that guarantees your life will turn around. But there is hope in recognizing who God is and what He has done for us through His Son. You know, we're in a series as we speak, in a series called Win the Day. It's the idea that we can take over the direction of our life by changing a few scripts in our life. And in fact, there are seven daily habits. Last week, we looked at flip the script, that our story, our past, does not have to define us. And today, we're in one entitled Kiss the Waves. The title comes from a quote that was reportedly ascribed to Pastor Charles Spurgeon. I have learned to kiss the wave that throws me against the Rock of Ages. In Mark chapter 6, we see the climax of the disciples' ignorance. They had just been sent out in pairs throughout the countryside, telling everyone they met to repent of their sins and to turn to God. And when the apostles returned to Jesus from their mission tour, they told him all that they had experienced. And we pick it up in verse 31. Then Jesus said, "Let's go off by ourselves to a quiet place and rest a while." He said this because there were so many people coming and going that Jesus and his apostles didn't even have time to eat. So they left by boat for a quiet place where they could be alone. Goes on, but many people recognized them and saw them leaving, and people from many towns ran ahead along the shore and got there ahead of them. Jesus saw the huge crowd as he stepped from the boat, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so he began teaching them many things. And what happened next was nothing short of miraculous. You've probably heard the story of the feeding of the people. Jesus told the disciples to collect food from all the people, but all they could come up with was a basket full of 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. And then, verse 41, Jesus took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, looked up toward heaven and blessed them. And then, breaking the loaves into pieces, he kept giving the bread to the disciples so they could distribute it to all the people. He also divided the fish for everyone to share. They all ate as much as they wanted. And afterwards, the disciples picked up 12 baskets of leftover bread and fish. A total of 5,000 men and their families were fed. I have to ask myself, I wonder what those 12 men were thinking as they handed out more and more and more food that Jesus had just made. What was going through their mind as they came back with baskets full of leftover food, all from 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. The point, of course, of the miraculous feeding was so that those who were there would know that Jesus is the bread of life. He's the giver of all things. But rather than seeing Jesus as the Son of God who could provide everything they would ever want or need, the disciples failed to connect the dots. The disciples were in awe of the sheer abundance of food, but they missed the one who made that very food. How easy it was for followers of Christ back then and for right now to experience the miraculous work of Christ in their lives and then moments later doubt whether he'll continue working among us. Jesus can be with us in one trial, but then at the very next one, we wonder if he's going to do anything about that one. How quickly we forget the identity of Jesus Christ as our sovereign Lord. While he went up into the hills to pray, Jesus then took his disciples and away from the crowd so they wouldn't fall prey to the political expectations. And the best place to send them would be across the northern part of the Sea of Galilee onto Bethsaida. The disciples were making their way across the sea when a storm came upon them. These professional sailors were having a rough night, soaked by the big waves and beaten down by the strong winds and darkness. It was a 6-hour trip to go through that. And yet, halfway through, they barely had gone very far at all. By this point, the men had been wrestling with the brutal storm for hours. What would the disciples expect to happen next? Jesus would save them, right? Well, we read in verse 48. He saw that they were in serious trouble, rowing hard and struggling against the wind and waves. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came toward them, walking on the water. He intended to go past them. Most people reading this passage rarely stop right there at that moment. Notice something strange there. He was walking on the water, not toward them, but he meant to pass them. Wait a minute, what? Wasn't Jesus on the water in order to save the disciples? Wasn't he coming to protect them from the very storm? Surely Jesus wasn't just out for some midnight stroll on the lake. He wasn't trying to race the disciples to the other side, was he? What was he doing? The question here is not whether Jesus wanted to help the disciples. Of course he did. The better question is, how did Jesus want to help the disciples? What did he want to help them with? You know, we know that Jesus could have stopped the storm in an instant, but he was not concerned with helping the disciples get to Bethsaida on time. He wanted something much bigger than that. He wanted the disciples to understand that he was and is in control over the entire universe. He wanted to reveal his very character to them. But the disciples didn't get it. They in fact thought he was a ghost. Over and over again, we read in the gospel, the disciples watched Jesus perform miracles, heal the hurting, preach incredible sermons, care for the poor, yet they failed to recognize the very Son of God. If only they had known that the man in their midst was the eternal Son of God in the flesh. If only they had known just how powerful and merciful he is, things would have been very different on that stormy night on the sea. See, Jesus did indeed have a purpose in his nighttime walk on the water. He intended to make the fact of his divinity crystal clear to his disciples. He meant to pass by disciples because he meant to show them that he was the Son of God, just as it happened many times in the Old Testament. We see examples like on Mount Sinai, Exodus 34. Then the Lord came down in a cloud and stood there with him, and he called out his own name, Yahweh. The Lord passed in front of Moses, calling out, Yahweh, the Lord, the God of compassion and mercy. I am slow to anger, and I am filled with unfailing love and faithfulness. Later again on that same mountain, 1 Kings 19:11, as Elijah stood there, the Lord passed by, and a mighty windstorm hit the mountain. It was such a terrible blast that the rocks were torn loose. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And here on the Sea of Galilee, Jesus was also revealing himself to his disciples. They were supposed to see him and make the connection. Jesus is God. See, only God can stretch out the heavens. Only God can move the mountains. Only God can walk on the water. There was to be no confusion today about Jesus' identity. The act of walking on water meant that Jesus is God in the flesh, but they still didn't get it. Verse 50 of Mark 6, they were all terrified when they saw him, but Jesus spoke to them at once and said, "Don't be afraid," he said, "take courage, the I am is here." It's the exact same identification God gave, remember, when he disclosed himself in Exodus chapter 3 to Moses. Jesus is taking God's name. He not only walks on water as only God can, but he also takes on God's very name. Jesus is telling his disciples, I know that you're going through a terrible, great trial right now. Don't fear. Take heart. The I am is here with you. But the disciples let their fear overwhelm them, and it blinded them to the Savior who was right there in front of them. We go on in this passage after the I am is here. Then he climbed into the boat and the wind stopped. And they were totally amazed, for they still didn't understand the significance of the miracles of the loaves. Their hearts were too hard to take it all in. So you have to ask, why didn't the disciples get it? Why were they so clueless? Well, Mark gives us an answer in verse 52. They still did not understand about the miracle with the loaves that they had witnessed earlier. You and I will face trials and will be tempted to doubt the sovereignty of Jesus. But this you may rest assured, you may not be responsible for the difficulties you have to endure, but you are responsible for how you deal with them. We have a choice in life, and that choice is we can either let obstacles destroy us, they can overcome us, they can tear us down, knock us down, or we can use them to our advantage. We can choose to be victorious despite our tragedy, despite our suffering, despite our pain. Now, choosing to not let the obstacles or the waves of life destroy us is in no way denying that those waves exist. We must not ignore that bad things happen. We need to accept them. We don't have to let them overtake us. Instead, we can make the decision to look for purpose in pain and strength through tragedy. How do we do that? Well, sometimes God delivers us from suffering. More often than not, though, he delivers us through the suffering. Notice the disciples were not being scolded for being disobedient. They hadn't done anything wrong. They were doing exactly what Jesus had told them to do. They were in the boat he had sent them on. They were on the sea that he had sent them over. They were struggling with the waves precisely because they were obedient. And here's the point. The disciples were exactly where Jesus wanted them, in the middle of an angry sea in a storm. Why would a God of mercy, a God of love, a God of compassion do this? Because he loved them so much. The disciples needed to recognize who Jesus is and to rely upon him. If they understand who Jesus really is here, they'd be able to trust him in every storm that came upon them. In the midst of storms in your life, have you forgotten at times who Jesus is? Do you doubt whether God intended for you to be in the storm-tossed boat in the first place? Do you take courage in the fact that Jesus is who he claims to be? When you remember Jesus, does your fear vanish away? You know, misunderstanding who Jesus is brings us only fear and distress. When we understand who Christ is, that he's our provider, he's our storm controller, we can have peace in the midst, the very midst of our life storms. Unfortunately, more often than not, we follow in the disciples' footsteps more than we would like to admit, right? We sail through life both on calm waters and rough seas, forgetting the one who commands the wind and the waves. I know I do this all the time. Some days I forget the power of God, and I get so discouraged with what's happening in my life at that point. But when I do that, I am responding as if I believe God is not in charge over every aspect of my life. James chapter 4 says something similar, verse 13 to 16. Look here, you who say today or tomorrow we're going to a certain town and we'll stay there a year, we'll do business there and we'll make a profit. How do you know what your life will be like tomorrow? Your life is like the morning fog. It's here a little while and then it's gone. What you ought to say is, if the Lord wants us to, we will live and do this and that. Otherwise, you're boasting about your own pretentious plans, and all such boasting is evil. We do not know what tomorrow holds for us. Only God does. Our lives may be like a morning fog, as the verse says, but it's a fog that God holds in his hand. It's a fog that he knows about and that he's in control of. Isn't that reassuring? Because it should be. Your hardship is not out of his control. God is always overseeing your life. It's sad to say, but oftentimes we go about our day-to-day existence as Christians, but as functional atheists. What do I mean by that phrase or term, functional atheist? We believe in Jesus, but we live our life sometimes like he doesn't even exist. We go through our days and we face our storms, forgetting him and what he has done for us. You may not think it in the depths of your pain, but your suffering can be a gift. How is that even possible? We may never know the purpose of every trial, of every pain. But as one writer put it, our view of God's way is like looking at the ocean from a beach. There's so much more of the ocean that you do not see than what you do see. Likewise, there's more to your trial than meets the eye. But it's hard to remember that when we misunderstand or we forget who Jesus really is. One of the best things we can do when we do mistake Christ's identity is to meditate on the scriptures that describe Jesus as the sovereign ruler of the entire cosmos, the entire universe. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 11. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power, the glory, the victory, and the majesty. Everything in the heavens and on earth is yours, O Lord, and this is your kingdom. We adore you as the one who is over all things. Wealth and honor come from you alone, for you rule over everything. Power and might are in your hand, and at your discretion, people are made great and given strength. In Job chapter 42, verse 2, I know that you can do anything and that no one can stop you. Psalm 103, verse 19, the Lord has made heaven his throne. From there he rules over everything. Psalm 115, verse 3, our God is in the heavens and he does what he wishes. Matthew 28, 18, Jesus came and told his disciples, I've been given all authority and in heaven and on earth. And finally, Ephesians 1, verse 11, furthermore, because we are united with Christ, we have received an inheritance from God, for he chose us in advance, and he makes everything work out according to his plan. When we know the truth of these verses, we know that our pain then is not an accident. God is in control over every swell of the waves. He's sovereign over every gust of wind. The answer to our fear and our stress and our pain and our troubles and our trials is not to merely get to the other side, but not to mistake Christ's identity in the very middle of that storm. When we go through seasons of suffering or pain, we're eager to get ourselves out of those situations, and understandably so. But sometimes we focus so hard on getting through the pain that we forget to grow through the pain. It's often beneficial to look for the lesson in the middle of your suffering season and ask God, Lord, what are you trying to teach me through all of this? We can find purpose through our suffering by discovering ways to not only help ourselves, but help others as well. For example, have you ever noticed that through suffering, you learn to better relate to those suffering the same fate? The way that God uses suffering for the betterment of our lives is a way that we develop a deeper empathy for those who suffer around us. When we grieve the loss of a loved one, we're able to better understand the emotions and the pain that someone else feels when they grieve over that same loss. When we find stress and frustration through economic trials, we're able to relate to someone else who's also experiencing those anxieties. When we let the past control us, we surrender ourselves to unhealthy coping mechanisms that keep us trapped in time. Whitney Surok was right there in the hospital, in front of her family the whole time. They looked at her, but could not see who she was, and they mistook her for someone else. Right in the middle of your pain, in the middle of your trouble, in the middle of your trials, Jesus is right there with you as well. He is the sovereign King of the universe who loves you, who cares for you, and is in control of your life. To experience peace in the middle of life's trials, we need to know that Jesus is the Son of God, and we need to live accordingly. Remind yourself of His power as you regularly read His Word. As you reflect on your life, remember all that God has already done for you. Remember the loaves and fishes of your life. And as you do so, it'll help you face the storms and waves when they inevitably arise out of a fallen world. We are guaranteed to have trouble, but how we respond is up to us. The waves may loom large in your life, but don't miss the loving and sovereign God who is so much larger, the one who sent the storms in the first place and holds you fast right there in the middle of it. We all face obstacles throughout our lives, and many times we allow those obstacles to overtake us. However, if we use these obstacles, these bad things that have happened to us, to our advantage, they can become our leverage rather than our downfall. So as Charles Spurgeon said, learn to kiss the wave that throws you against the rock of ages. And by doing so, you'll find strength through life's storms. Let's go before the Lord.